Hi everybody, this is Peter Laws. Welcome back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. Now this episode is going to be a little bit different because basically I'm going to share with you an interview with me that I gave on BBC Radio recently. I was invited to go and speak to them about the upcoming book that I announced in the last episode, where I'm writing a book that explores why normal everyday people are drawn to the macabre, spooky and downright repellent. And this book's called The Frighteners, and I was chatting a little bit about that book, but also about my novel that's coming out in the new year, in February 16. And anyway, they asked me onto this show, and I thought nothing of it, and then I suddenly thought, oh, actually, I suppose, you know, around the world, people don't necessarily have access to BBC iPlayer and things like that, so I was able to put the show into my podcast, if you'd like to hear it. So that's coming up now. Now, the show was actually, I was interviewed by a man called Bob Fisher, and part of this show was, excuse me, my phone just went off in the background, part of this show was basically me choosing a whole bunch of music. So for the hour of the interview, I got to choose all the different songs. Now, for copyright reasons, I'll need to fade the songs in and out. So if you hear just the snippets of the songs that I chose, you'll understand why. But anyway, you may be interested in the chat that we had. This is me chatting to Bob Fisher. It was recorded at the end of September in BBC Radio Tees. And yeah, it's coming up now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is BBC Tees. It's Bob Fisher here. And if you bear with me, I might just have a jingle to play.
Bob Fisher, BBC Tees.
I run a very tight ship on this programme, as you can tell. Yes, BBC Tees, 95 FM, DAB and online. bbc.co.uk/tees. My after two guest today is a Baptist minister. He is a man of the cloth, but he's also a writer with some unusual interests. He writes about vintage horror films and he's currently working on a book called The Frighteners. He is looking, in his own words, for people who have coffins in their lounges or dress as vampires at the weekends. Although he's now in leafy Bedfordshire, he was born and raised in the northeast. He is the Reverend Peter Laws, and we'll chat to him live on the other side of one of his musical choices. David Soul and Silver Lady, chosen by my after two guests today. The Reverend Peter Laws is with me live. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Bob. Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
Excellent stuff. I good to find a fellow David Soul fan out there. Can I hazard a guess here? Was your mum a big fan of David Soul when you were a kid?
Not particularly, but I'll tell you why I was into that song is because I saw a TV movie called Salem's Lot, which is based on a Stephen King, and he was in that, Starsky and Hutch attacking and running away from vampires, and I remember thinking, he was this guy in the vampire movie, and I found this single in my mum's house and played it, and I was like, wow. It was like one of the first times I'd been introduced to a funky bass line.
I think of David Soul very much as the godfather of funk.
Yeah.
You were a tiny bit too young for Starsky and Hutch then, I'm guessing.
Well, I remember they had a vampire episode in that too. But
did they?
Yeah, but I ended up buying the album, the David Soul album, like years later, and I realised the rest of it just sounded a bit like sort of a Barry Manilow album.
There's a few slushy ballads in his oeuvre, yeah. Let's say that much. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your upbringing, because you are from the northeast. Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
I'm from Chester Street.
Hmm.
Although, for some reason, other people tend to call it Chester Lee Street, but I'm Chester Street.
Yeah, no, spoken like a native.
Yeah.
And did you grow up with this interest in the horror and the supernatural? I mean, you mentioned Salem's Lot there. Was that something you saw on TV as a small kid?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was like 1981 when that came out. Yeah. So I suppose I might have been maybe about like 10 or 8 or something when I saw that. Obviously, some of the bits were pretty scary, but no, I was always a fan of that sort of stuff. Not just horror. I loved Knight Rider and the A-Team and all the other stuff. But yeah, it was something about those spooky things that really got me thinking.
What do you think it was?
I think maybe because it was... sort of talking about another world as if there was something else out there, the idea of the supernatural existing, and maybe we're not alone, maybe there's more to life than flesh and blood. I mean, Knight Rider didn't really go into that sort of territory, but...
It's got a talking car in it.
Yeah, well, true, yeah.
But it was that kind of glimpse beyond the veil.
In some ways, I mean, that's why in some ways it's linked to... into my spirituality, because it was an interesting doorway into thinking, hey, maybe there is more to life than just me going to school and me hanging out with my friends. What happens if there's some sort of cosmic stuff going on?
So did those feelings start at quite a young age then? You weren't from a religious family or a religious background at all?
No, not at all, really. I mean, my family weren't anti-religious or anything, but we never went to church and never really had much of a practical interest in it. It was only when I was older that I started really paying attention to it. To be honest, up until I left, up until the university, I was pretty anti-Christian and anti-organized religion.
Yeah. Why was that?
I don't know. I think I just got the impression that Christianity wants to ruin your life. That it would, it would come along and it would tell you can't do certain things, or you have to believe certain doctrines all the time, and there's no wriggle room. And I think I was put off by it. But to be honest, the main reason I was put off is because I didn't really get to meet many other Christians, and so I only had, Dot Cotton and Harold Bishop, who played the tuba. These were my examples of Christianity. Cliff Richard, they weren't necessarily indicative of the people I would end up meeting when I got a bit older.
Was it as part of a wider anti-authoritarian stance then, do you think? Yeah. I mean, did you have similar problems with your school teachers and your parents to a certain extent?
Not really, no. I mean, I was kind of fairly well-behaved, I suppose. Mm. But I was a bit of a Iago character from Othello, like going to my friends and sort of encouraging them to do something which I thought was hilarious, and they'd end up getting in trouble.
What did you get them into bother for?
Oh, it's all sorts of stuff. I mean, I couldn't really tell you these things on air. It involved lots of chalk and walls, but anyway.
Okay. Oh, chalk washes off. I wouldn't feel too bad about that.
It wasn't always chalk.
Okay. You telling me as well that your childhood antics extended to basically ghost hunting. You weren't just sitting at home watching horror films on TV. You actively went out and looked for ghosts.
Yeah, definitely. And part of that, to be honest, was fueled by a radio show on Metro Radio, which was Alan Robson. Remember Alan? He's still going, isn't he?
It's still going strong. Night Owls.
Yeah, Night Owls. So I used to listen to Night Owls now and again, but without fail on the Halloween special, I would listen to that, because that was just so spooky and so scary, lying in bed at night and listening to Alan Robson tell all these scary stories. And so things like that were sort of real tales of the supernatural. There were people sitting at home, just living in Washington or Whitley Bay or something like that, and saying, I saw a ghost at the end of my bed. And I'm like, well, let's get out there and see if that stuff's there.
I used to listen to the same thing as well. And I think part of me was the same as you, utterly fascinated and a bit scared by it. I used to find it quite funny as well. This is kind of, Alan, I saw a translucent figure standing at the foot of me bed. And Alan Robson would say, well, I keep an open mind about these things. But where did you go ghost hunting? Where were you looking for them?
We went all over the place, and sometimes it wasn't even like, oh, that's a renowned haunted spot. It was just that those woods look pretty spooky. There's probably a ghost in there. Mm. But one of the ones I do remember going to was Dunstanburgh Castle. We went there really late at night. One of my friends had a car, and we hopped over the fence after hours and ran over there. And if you've been to Dunstanburgh Castle, it's so epic looking. And we went up there and just looked around. We didn't see anything, but the thrills were there, definitely.
Were you a believer then? I mean, did you actively believe in ghosts and the supernatural as a physical thing?
Yeah, I wanted to believe, but I have quite a healthy dose of cynicism as well. Yeah. And so it was more like a quest to try and find if there was something more to life than just, everyday things. But occasionally, when people would tell these stories, they've seen something, I would think, oh, wow, that's amazing. And half of me like, yeah, whatever, don't believe it.
Ever had an experience yourself?
Nothing massively that I would say. I think now I can look back on things that I in the past would have said that was a ghost or a UFO.
Yeah.
And maybe that was fueled by a few too many brown ales in the past, or or sometimes just wishful thinking. But there have been a few things that are difficult to explain. I like that there's a grey area.
Yeah.
Not knowing.
I think the human imagination can be a great thing sometimes, can't it? But that's not the whole story, I don't think, sometimes.
True.
Yeah. We'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more, Peter, if that's okay. And talk about your work as a minister and about the two books that you've got in the pipeline here as well, which is very exciting. Reverend Peter Laws here on BBC Tees with me, Bob Fisher. Peter Laws is my after two guest on the programme today. Northeastern born Baptist minister and a man with a penchant for the macabre as well. He's working on a couple of books, one a novel and one a non-fiction book, both looking at various elements of the supernatural. Shall we play another track here, Peter? Yeah. I'm going to play some Depeche Mode. Tell me about your love of Depeche Mode.
Well, this song in particular, I just love this song. I remember, I think it was when I was at university, I was listening to this song, and it was around the time when I was thinking about, you know, whether God's real and all this sort of stuff. And I don't know whether or not other people feel connected with cosmic things through listening to Depeche Mode, but I certainly did with this song. And I love how noise, this song is noise. It's great. I love it.
How long does the noise go on for at the start of this?
The noise will die down very, very soon.
I've heard that before. Here we go. It's Depeche Mode. I Feel You. Depeche Mode, I Feel You, chosen by our after two guests today. The Reverend Peter Laws, Northeastern born Baptist minister, who's writing quite extensively about the supernatural, various elements of the macabre. Peter is live with me on the programme today. You saying that was a big university song for you, and it is a song that kind of describes a Christian dawning, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, in some ways, a general religious one, but certainly for me, at the time I was like thinking about the idea of Christianity, because up until that point I hadn't really ever paid attention to it. And I just remember that song seemed to sum up what was going on. I was like, whoa, this is the dawning of something new going on in my life.
Yeah. Where did that come from? Where did that spirituality come from? As you know, somebody who, as you say, spent your childhood being very cynical about organized religion. It's something of a turnaround, isn't it? Did it take you by surprise?
It did. Let me be honest, right? I was in a nightclub. I saw a girl and I fancied her and I asked her, I says, can I buy you a drink, right?
Yeah.
And she said no. And I was trying to sort of chat her up. And basically she was saying that she didn't want to go out with me or pursue anything with me because I wasn't a Christian. And I'm like, huh? I'd never heard this, you know, line before. And I thought, well, you could have just said I'm ugly or something. But no, she went for this line. And she wasn't a weirdo or anything. She was just saying this was a really important part of her life. And she was looking for someone who shared that. And it just made me think, maybe I'll go to the Christian Union because maybe she'll be around. But also half of me, frankly, at that stage was starting to ask some of the big questions. Where do we come from? You know, what happens when we die?
Yeah.
And all that stuff. And yeah, eventually I just started meeting Christians who were intelligent and didn't seem to leave their brain at the door and still believed this stuff. So.
Oh, and what were you studying at the time?
I was studying applied social science. Mm. A little bit of philosophy. I'm one of those types. And and so I naturally think in sort of big conceptual terms.
Yeah.
I won't remember your phone number, but I will remember the deep debates we had. So so that's the sort of stuff that I did. But yeah, certainly after going along to this Christian Union, I just found myself thinking, wow, maybe it's not intellectual suicide to pursue the idea that God exists.
Yeah. I know, but you had some degree of faith before that then, or was the whole thing absolutely new to you?
Well, I had faith in the potential of the supernatural, like I said earlier. And when I watched films like The Exorcist, for example, which I remember I got on some sort of bootleg VHS copy.
Because it was from banned? Yes.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And I found it in Chesley Street Market for £5. And I bought it. And I remember being genuinely scared when I was watching that. And I was thinking, why am I more scared by this than watching American Werewolf in London or something? And I was just starting to realize that maybe I'm open to the idea that there's such a thing as the devil. And I'm like, well, if I'm open to that, you know, there's a flip side to that as well. So yeah, I had some inklings, but I think when I became a Christian at university, that was based on discovering the whole Jesus stuff and
The whole Bible. Jesus stuff.
Yeah, yeah, you know, that bit.
Spoken like which a true Baptist of, minister.
Yeah, which is kind of central, of course.
Yes, yeah. Do you see that, given your childhood interest in the supernatural, your lifelong interest in the supernatural, do you see it as part of the same thing, almost? I mean, both are looking at the existence of something that we can't physically prove.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm writing this book called The Frighteners, which is trying to explore why people are drawn to this stuff. And often that those sorts of people are classed as like complete freaks or unnatural or weirdos. But actually, for many people, it's not just a morbid interest, but it's a bit more epic than that. It's a sense of, you know, what happens if I go and see a horror movie and that thrills me in a certain way. We live in such a relentlessly rational society which says there's no such thing as anything beyond flesh and blood, and I just think horror for me and those and reading Stephen King and H.P. Lovecraft and all that stuff opened my eyes to a wider world, and so that in a way prepared the ground for me to find the biggest one of all, I guess, which is God himself.
Are you frustrated that we live in a very science and rationalism driven society?
No, not at all. I'm a very rational thinker myself, and this might sound odd, but I'm quite open to the possibility that Christianity may just not be true in the end. It of course you can't be so blinkered to say without a single shadow of a doubt God exists. Of course he may not exist, but there is evidence for me to think that he may well exist. But I'm very in favor of rationality, but not at the expense of being unscientific about it. And so in the same way as if you see some sort of weird supernatural thing going on in someone's house and they'll, for some reason, people will say, look, there can't be any other supernatural reason, and they'll come up with a real world reason, which actually seems even more ridiculous than the unlikely one. So I don't like being blinkered one way or the other. I like to try and keep an open mind.
Tell me about The Frighteners then. You mentioned this book that you're working on. Is it a Louis Theroux-style investigation of people that are drawn to these things?
Yes, it is. So it's certainly not an academic text, but basically it's me, and it's coming out from a publisher called Icon, and then there's a different publisher in America who's going to be bringing it out as well over there. And it's really me meeting psychologists and philosophers and evolutionary biologists to try and understand why people might embrace the morbid, but it's also me meeting people who may be classed as having an enthusiastic feeling towards dark things, and also me having a few scary experiences of my own. Just on Sunday gone, I was in Essex in an underground bunker, a nuclear bunker, and I was given a pump action shotgun.
Really?
With a bunch of other guys. Not a real one, I hasten to add.
Like it's not paintballing, is it?
No, it's like it's shooting air pellets.
Okay.
But anyway, we all had to go down in this underground bunker. All the lights were off, and then they released a whole bunch of zombies to chase us. And for 2.5 hours, basically in the dark, I was getting chased by these crazy zombies. And so it's me also experiencing how our culture has a growing interest in not just the supernatural, but simulated fear situations. I find that interesting.
Zombies have been everywhere the last few years, haven't they? There's been a lot of zombies around.
Yeah, I know. I'm wondering when werewolves are going to kick back in, but zombies, they're everywhere.
And is that the nuclear bunker in Essex? I think I've driven somewhere past that. And
you might have driven over it.
Quite possibly. For miles down the road approaching it, there were road signs pointing to secret nuclear bunker.
Yeah,
it's not that secret.
Yeah, exactly. I know what you mean. But it's great. It's called The Last Survivors, the company. And basically, they just have people under there. And when you get to this bunker, it's in the middle of nowhere. And there's a cottage that's on the, like a farm cottage. And you think there's nothing there. But you go through it and you go underground and you're in this giant place.
Was this part of research for the book, or was it just a relaxing weekend?
Well, it was a bit of both.
Yeah,
really. It wasn't really relaxing. I've got a heart monitor strapped to me, right, throughout this research period, where I'm just making notes. I've got it on now. I've been making notes about whether or not being on radio might up my heart rate a little bit.
And how's it looking so far?
That's looking all right. I think I'm going to survive. I think I'm gonna
make
it.
Do another half hour of this, can you?
Yeah, I can make it. 1 minute more, though. It's flatline. But no, so I can measure how scary some of these things are. But like, there's another experience called Snuff House, which happens in Lancashire, and that sounds a little bit more intense. So I'll be probably being involved in that early next year. And yeah, that's a little bit more of a extreme scare attraction. But again, they're growing in the country and worldwide, and the book explores why.
Dare I ask, Peter, what on earth is Snuff House?
Well, I was looking at the website recently, and it seems to be, and I'm not really into this type of thing, but I'm supposed to research these things thoroughly.
Yeah.
It is almost like a simulated kidnap scenario where people genuinely are paying £90 or £60 or whatever it is to be bundled into a van, taken to a place, and be subjected to what you could call a psychological roller coaster.
Okay.
Now, I don't know how extreme it's going to be, and they have safe words and things if you need to get out of that. And I'm not an idiot, you know. I don't want to do anything that's like really, really dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ignore these more extreme things if I'm going to research the book thoroughly. So yeah, I'm going to check it out.
When are you doing that?
That I think is in the new year. They've been doing it throughout this year, and then they've got a new one in the new year. So I think it's May or something. But it's part of this giant Scare Kingdom screen park in Lancashire that do all sorts of stuff. It's a growing industry.
Oh, you and I have both spent time in Lancashire. None of that is particularly out of keeping with the culture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Spooky place.
Let's play a little bit more music here. James Taylor, Peter.
Yeah.
Why this particular song?
Well, I quite like this song. You're getting a theme here, but it's about a guy who's dead.
Yeah.
And then, like hundreds and hundreds of years later, he's thawed out, and he's alive, and he just is curious to know what his grave looks like. And I just think it's a pretty beautiful song. And James Taylor, great guitar player, wonderful singer.
It's called The Frozen Man. James Taylor, The Frozen Man, here on BBCT's, chosen by my After Two guest today, the Reverend Peter Laws. He's Baptist minister, born and brought up in the Northeast, and currently researching a book called The Frighteners, tracking down people who are drawn to the darker, more macabre side of life. Who have you spoken to then so far, Peter? Any interesting characters that you've met? Have you met somebody with a coffin in their front room?
Actually, yes, I have. I was speaking recently at a conference in Reading, on whether God believes in ghosts. And at this conference, I was having a lovely dinner with these two ladies. And we were just talking about these sorts of subjects. And she whipped her phone out and she showed me that her boyfriend had made her a coffin. Her
okay.
coffin.
For her to use?
For her to use.
Ultimately.
He wasn't holding an axe in the other hand and saying, get in. but he had done this and she has this in her house on display. And now, I can understand that loads of people out there would be like, oh my word, that is crazy. And yet it was really fascinating talking to her, because she was just basically saying that our society is so freaked out and ill at ease with death, they talk about it as if it's not natural.
Mm.
When, of course, death is the most natural thing in the world. So part of the book, it tries to explore and contrast Victorian society with modern society. Because in the Victorian age, death was much more in your face, as it were.
Yeah.
And yet sex was buried. And then it seems to have flipped around the other direction these days, that sexuality is talked about more openly, and that's a good thing. But death, by contrast, has been buried. Oh, that's clever.
Oh, yeah.
It has been buried. See what I did there?
I think it's even a fairly recent development, because I watch a lot of vintage sitcoms. Because I have a lot of time. Actually, I don't have a lot of time on my hands anymore. I do this every day. But I watch things like Last of the Summer Wine, I can watch in the 1970s. And the attitude to death in something like that is, you know, there is the coffin. It's open. It's in the front room. Everyone's standing around it eating sandwiches.
Absolutely.
Unthinkable, I think.
Yeah, I mean, now these people days. Would... Yeah, I mean, some people would just find that would be distasteful or wrong. And I can completely understand those feelings. But in a way, it's strange that we make a very natural thing feel like the most unnatural thing.
Hmm. Has anybody tried to talk you out of your interest in the darker side of life and in horror and, you know, anybody within the church?
Yes, I'll be honest with you. When I first became a Christian, one of the things that put me off actually becoming a Christian was because sometimes I would hear preachers or read books and things that were saying, you know, if you're a Christian and if you love God, you cannot watch films that are over PG, and you're not allowed to be interested in unusual and dark things. Mm. And I was thinking, oh man, this is kind of an interest of mine. And so that put me off. And when I became a Christian, there were some people who said I'd need to ditch all of this stuff. So I did, in the early years of Christianity, I got rid of a bunch of like horror films. Like I had a really cool collection of vinyl soundtracks to obscure horror movies, which I now have found out are worth like £90 or £100 each.
Oh no.
And I like chucked some of them.
Charity shops.
I sold some on Chester right. Street to a guy on Chester Street Market. So he's sitting on a little gold mine. And now I'm starting to buy some of that vinyl back. So there was a period when I kind of went horror cold turkey. But I was doing a master's degree in theology and preaching. And for that dissertation, I was trying to find out, well, what happens if God exists? What happens if his fingerprints are on the most unlikely places? And I just felt that horror films and those sorts of things have always been a part of our culture.
Hmm.
Scary stories around the campfire. And I'd just be interested to see if there's some way that could be a learning experience and not just a negative one all the time.
So you see God in some of these dark things as well?
Well, in some ways. I mean, okay, you could say, how do you see God in a Saw movie, which is just relentless torture? Although those films, I mean, they're all about justice and sort of badness being punished, which I guess goes towards the sort of the old school version, you know, of God coming and wanting to ruin you. Mm. But to be honest, part of it is this reminder that we're not going to live forever on this earth, as it were. And the longer we deny that, the less we take advantage of this life as it is. You know, so many of us just chill out and just, you know, stare at Facebook all day. Mm. And oddly enough, if you'll meet people who've been given bad news or they've experienced a death in the family, that negative experience can almost make life become richer because they're like, oh my word, I'm going to spend time with my kids today. So there is a positivity sometimes in looking into the abyss, but you don't want to like throw yourself in it. I mean, you still want to enjoy life and dance and have fun and eat pizza and, you know, I'm not relentlessly bleak.
You're good. Charming and cheery.
Well, thank you.
No, it's cute because I'm a big fan of Wilco Johnson, musician.
Okay.
Who was diagnosed with terminal cancer a couple of years ago, and he said, conversely enough, as he walked out of the hospital after receiving his diagnosis, he felt more alive than he'd ever felt. He noticed the colour of the flowers as he walked past them. It's things that, you know, the sound of the bird song. He just never noticed any of this before. But it was having that interaction, if you like, with his own mortality that made him appreciate the living world so much more.
Yeah, and nobody is saying that. So isn't it great? You should be happy if you get a really bad diagnosis because you'll enjoy life more.
Of course,
I mean, it's still devastating.
Yeah.
But there are positive things that may come in those where that we just miss when life is going completely perfectly all the time.
Absolutely. We'll come back and we'll talk some more, Peter, if that's okay.
Yeah, cool.
I'm going to play another track of yours. Why Kool & the Gang's Jungle Boogie?
Oh man, this is just an amazing track. I mean, people are going crazy throughout this track, all this sort of the wibbles and the squeaks and grunts. But I think it's one of the most finest bass lines ever created. It goes down, then up, and then the trumpets kick in. You'll see, it's amazing.
I think they have more of a claim to being the godfathers of funk than David Soul has, let's put it that way.
Oh, they learned everything from David Soul.
Didn't we all?
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure what happened there. Well, we heard most of Kool & the Gang's Jungle Boogie. Peter, I can only apologise. I think the funk just got a little bit too much for BBC Tees.
Yeah. You funked out the whole system.
I tell you what, we'll take a quick travel break and then we'll come back and talk some more. Okay. The Reverend Peter Laws is my guest today. He was born in the Northeast. He's a Baptist minister and he's writing quite a lot about the supernatural and about horror films and the macabre in general. What are your sermons like, Peter? Are they quite off the wall? Do you incorporate any of this stuff into the pulpit?
Well, I always dress as a zombie to do everyone, of course. No, they're really quite normal. And particularly when I'm speaking in churches, I mean, not everybody in a church has the spooky gene, as it's sometimes known as. And so, yeah, it's just a straight up normal sermon. So I don't really talk a lot about horror and scary stuff there.
Right, okay. It's not like, you know,
unless I'm asked. I have been asked, actually. I have been asked in my own church. I'm in Amtill in Bedfordshire. I've been asked to speak on the subject Jesus loves zombies. So
have you? Who asked you to do that?
The youth worker. He's putting on like an event where people can come in and sort of simulated sort of like for teenagers can experience what it would be like to try and get out of a zombie apocalypse or something. And that's happening in our church. And so he's asking me to do a sort of talk to try and tie it all together. So that should be fascinating. But that doesn't happen often. Normally it's just...
So it was all coffee mornings when I was a lad.
Oh, yeah. They're the most scary of all.
You sat there dreaming of a zombie apocalypse. I'm going to play another one of your musical choices. And we can probably natter over this a little bit because it's a fine, moody instrumental. But it's a piece of music by John Carpenter, who's a very, very fine horror film director who made Halloween and The Fog. So John Carpenter, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And he's an amazing composer. And I'm going to see him live in London.
Oh,
on Halloween.
You?
Yeah. The first time he's come to London to play live, and I'm stoked about that.
Is this from an album of original music that he's made? He normally makes his own film soundtracks, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was writing soundtracks back in the 70s and then the 80s and through the 90s. But he's had a break. He doesn't really make films anymore. Mm. But he's been putting out this cool electronica music, which just seems to be very, very popular. And you can see a lot of dance music influence in the work of John Carpenter. I think he's a bit of a genius.
We'll have a little listen to this for a minute, and then we might chunter over it, if that's okay, Peter.
Here
we go.
Sounds good.
It's called Vortex. John Carpenter and Vortex. Is that from a full new album that he's made then, Peter?
Yeah, he's made a couple of new albums, and that's one from John Carpenter's Lost Themes, so it's themes from films he never made.
Right, okay, yes. He's made the soundtracks, but not the actual films.
That's right. Okay.
Tell us a little bit about the novel that you're... Well, you finished it, haven't you? It's been published in February.
Yeah, that's right. I finished the first two, actually.
Oh, blimey.
What happened about 4 years ago, I was working in churches, and then I felt that it was time to start exploring creative writing and writing for magazines and things like that. Mm. And so even though I'm still a Baptist minister, I speak at churches, I'm not currently looking after a congregation anywhere.
Oh, okay.
And that's because not because they were scared of me, I promise you, but it was because the Baptist Union just gave me an opportunity to explore this more creative stuff. So in that time, I've been trying to get a book deal. I wrote 4 novels, got a lot of rejections, but then in January, a UK publisher, gave me a 2-book deal. It's called Alison and Busby, the publisher, and they're going to publish my first 2 novels. The first one comes out, it's called Purged, and it's in shops February 16th.
And as far as I can see, I'll read your own blurb back at you here, Peter, which is always terribly embarrassing, but I'm going to do it anyway. So Purged is about a disgraced ex-vicar who debunks Christianity and also helps to solve paranormal crimes.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah? I hesitate to ask, but where does the character come from, Peter?
I know. Tell me about... Yeah, well, I'm not that imaginative, you see. I was trying to think something up and I spotted a mirror and I went, there, that dude.
You're not disgraced, surely.
Well, sometimes.
Okay.
No, but yeah, I mean, I certainly remember reading a lot of Stephen King, and he was on about write what you know, and he's so often writing about writers in his books, and he's a writer himself, obviously.
Mm.
And I tried to write a book which was like a policeman solving crimes. And then I just was like, I can't get my head around that. I don't understand it enough. And so I've written this about this ex-vicar who helps the police solve like religiously motivated crimes, cult-related crimes, and supposedly supernatural. But he doesn't believe in any of this stuff. He's an atheist. He just thinks it's all bunk. But
right.
So he's like the voice that comes in and says, look, that body may be covered in weird symbols, but the devil didn't do that. It's this weirdo guy down the road.
It's people that do that, yes, yeah.
But there are hints of the supernatural within there.
Right, But he uses his religious background, I guess, to be able to get into the head of people that are committing religiously themed crimes.
Yes, and also him having an amazing knowledge of like church history and all different religious history, he's able to sort of spot obscure symbology, or he's able to understand the motivations. But there's actually a surprising amount of crimes that are committed by people who have religious motives, so I wanted to explore that.
Okay. So when's it out again?
It's out February 16th. It's called Purged.
Fabulous. We'll do a bit more on it when it comes out, if that's okay, Peter.
That'd be great, so, yeah.
Fascinated by that. In the meantime, you've got you've got a website, haven't you, and a YouTube channel and all sorts, if people want to come and find you.
Yeah, peterlaws.co.uk, pretty simple. And also, if you ever just search for the Flicks That Church Forgot on YouTube or Facebook, I've got a YouTube channel where I review horror movies on there and sometimes do crazy musical cover versions of songs from films, and got a podcast. So Twitter at Rev Peter Laws.
Yeah. And you'd find you have a monthly film column in a magazine called The Fortean Times, which we're both enormously fond of. It's the Journal of Strange Phenomena.
Yes, I do. I'm a big fan of that magazine. And I've been writing a column for them once a month, for a few years now.
Good stuff. Well, look, good luck with it all, Peter.
Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Really appreciate it.
And you too, Bob.
And we're going to play one final track here. An artist that I don't know anything about whatsoever. Tell me about Eli.
Oh, yeah, this is just a song. I mean, I don't really know many of the songs by Eli. I did get his album, but this was the song that really stood out. It's just this idea of, you know, you live through your life, things go crazy, all sorts of things go up. But I like the idea that he says he's basically listing the things he's prayed for in his life.
Yeah.
For me, you know, when life goes crazy, I'm appreciative of the fact that I can pray and, you know, talk to God about these sorts of things. So this song, I feel, sums up that.
Lovely to speak to you, Peter.
And you too, Bob. Thank you.
The Reverend Peter Laws here on BBC Tees with me, Bob Fisher.